welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And I am going to talk about Galaxy Quest, the comedy Galaxy Quest starring Tim Allen. Yes, you know, Galaxy Quest, Tim Allen. It's actually a really brilliantly structured, extremely well-written mainstream comedy. If you haven't seen Galaxy Quest, I do recommend it. Especially if you plan to listen to this, my analysis of Galaxy Quest, wherein I will lay out all the plot and everything that happens and ruin the whole film for you. So consider that your spoiler alert if you haven't already seen Galaxy Quest. Also, if you haven't already signed up to my newsletter, Strange Ink, go to strangeink.ca, sign up to the newsletter. Let's keep in touch. I'll tell you what's going on with me. I'll share some writing tips with you. I'll share some new work with you. I'll give you some recommendations for great, you know, movies and films and books and other things. And just generally kind of keep you in touch. Strangeink.ca is where to find my newsletter sign up. It's where to find me. You know, the best way to keep in touch isn't social media. It's not going on Twitter or X or any of that insanity. The best way to keep in touch is you email me, I email you. So sign up to strangeink.ca. Let's circumvent the whole Musk-esque Bezos-style system of Zuckerbergs and just keep in touch one-on-one here. And now, without further ado, let's talk about Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest has a very tight script in the sense that it's incredibly well structured, and it shows you how you can do a pretty mainstream movie, but have some real niche elements. So Star Trek, of course, is a big deal now, but in a certain sense, it's still a niche thing. You know, it's science fiction, which, you know, has had an explosion recently, but is, you know, as a genre, relatively niche. It's a certain particular show in science fiction. Of course, Star Trek is huge. It has this huge following. It has this huge universe. Star Trek is what they're parodying, of course, with the Galaxy Quest show. But it's, in many ways, this is a film that is less for fans of science fiction and Star Trek, although it does kind of appeal to those fans. It kind of is making fun of but also treating with love this fandom that has developed around, you know, these particular science fiction shows. At the same time, it's playing off of some of those stereotypes as they appear in mainstream culture. So you could know nothing about Star Trek but have heard of Trekkies and still sort of, you know, understand what they're trying to get at with this show. And then, of course, the broad idea is like I say, it's more broad than the niche, but it does sort of have a niche set of elements. This is what we call a high concept film. You might hear this term bandied about here and there, you know, high concept. What high concept refers to, what it means, is this sort of film where you can summarize in a quick log line, in a single sentence, you know, the premise. And the premise suggests a clear sort of idea or conflict in terms of how this film might work. So, you know, Galaxy Quest is a film about, the cast of a cult science fiction show named Galaxy Quest is mistakenly put into this scenario where an alien race that views this show as historical documents has brought them into their conflict, you know, has got them to commandeer to take over this conflict. So this, you know, the cast of the science fiction show is called to enact the story in real life in the midst of a true alien war. that idea has in it very clearly a set of conflicts. You can just see the conflicts without, you know, knowing anything about how this show is going to develop. You can imagine it just is rife with conflict. It's obvious, a direct conflict. It's a big, bombastic sort of movie style conflict, right? You know, you can very easily imagine that movie, and you know whether you're in or out. High concept films have that quality where you instantly know if you want to watch that movie or not. Now, you may or may not like it after you've watched it, but you have a very clear sense of the concept. You know, high concept has a very clear concept that is playing with very particular conflicts that are very obvious. You know what type of show that is, just hearing the summary or description of it. You know, you see the poster, you know what the movie is. That's sort of what high concept is. It can be summarized in that sort of way, and the type of thing it is clear to the audience, and sort of how the story might unfold is similarly sort of clear. What this allows the audience to do is imagine, just on the basis of the poster, just on the basis of, you know, seeing the one little one sentence description on Netflix or whatever, the audience can imagine and get a clear sense of the kinds of fun and games, you know, that might be in the show. You know, if you're going to watch a show like, you know, based on this premise, you just know that you're going to have, you know, especially if you know the show Star Trek, you know you would have certain, you know, tropes that are coming into play. You know that there's going to be somebody transported at one point, right? You know, they're going to beam them up, Scotty, right? Like that whole, you know, that sort of transportion thing is going to happen at some point in the film. And there'll be some sort of jokey take on that. You know, there'll be a character who either is wearing a red shirt and gets killed, you know, on the planet, or is kind of worried about that, you know, the one character here. Didn't have a name on the show. He was sort of a red shirt. He's not really literally wearing a red shirt in this film here, but in Star Trek, you know, those are the sorts of the terms that fans would use to talk about the characters who just sort of appeared and then died in the episode in order to raise the stakes. So you've got somebody who's kind of worrying he might be a red shirt. By the way, a really interesting novel that uses the same premise and probably does a lot much better job with it is this book Red Shirts by John Scalzi. So I really recommend that book to people who liked Galaxy Quest or simply didn't like Galaxy Quest but thought the idea had promise. John Scalzi's Red Shirts is, you know, again a much better expression of this thing in my view, but Galaxy Quest has a lot to recommend, especially in terms of looking at how this thing is put together. So let's just look for the minute at the very start of the film. So the film opens with the show Galaxy Quest. So it actually shows us, you know, some of the actual show. And then it kind of transitions to them being on a panel, right? We get the line, you know, never give up, never surrender. We get, you know, activate the Omega 13, right? Notice how that's being set up from, you know, moment one, right? You know, the ending is being set up right in the beginning. Activating the Omega 13, you can tell if you're savvy about film structure and story structure, you can watch the first minutes of this film and see, oh, what's going to have to happen at the end of this film is they're going to have to activate the Omega 13. Well, why wouldn't they activate the Omega 13 immediately? The answer to that the film gives is that nobody knows what the Omega 13 does. Most people assume it's going to destroy everything in the universe or cause some similarly devastating explosion. And it's therefore, you know, a resort to be used last, one that really doesn't help you much. Either it does nothing, right? Because the show never really used it other than, well, the show kept using it, but in this way that, you know, was very malleable and didn't make a lot of sense. This is all being set up right in the early moments. We get, you know, introduced to the characters, right, at the convention. We get very much the differences between Tim Allen's character, you know, our captain, and the other characters. We get that they're sort of a group They're sort of united in a sense, even though they all have their own like divisions, their own sort of interests. They're not really a cohesive unit in the sense that they're not really working together exactly. They're having, you know, conflict, but the core conflict is between the captain and them. He's enjoying this because he gets to be the star. They don't enjoy it as much. They're sort of being, you know, dragged along. You know, the show has sort of victimized them in a sense of typecasting them. He similarly maybe has been typecast, but he's managed to kind of enjoy it more or less. At least that's how it seems. As we sort of start to progress through this opening, what we see is that, you know, he's spending his nights alone. He's getting drunk, you know, by himself. He doesn't really have friends. You know, these people are the closest thing he has to friends, and they don't really like him. You know, they resent him, and he's, you know, got a more positive attitude about it. But in many ways, it's clear as the thing goes on that that's a bit of a show. You know, he's sort of acting like he's happier than he is. And he's even managed to convince himself to a certain degree. You know, there's a level at which the whole like opening of this act of this show, on one hand, is really setting forth the plot. You know, so it's setting up all the things. We see the Thermians, you know, at the convention prior to actually realizing who they are. We see Justin Long's character, and you know they're going to start these, you know, real core hardcore fans of the show that have done the work, like the fan service work of actually designing the ship in, you know, a computer simulation and so on and so forth. You know, they studied the show to the point where they know everything that there is to know about the ship, and of course the Thermians have built it similarly, you know, as the Ultra fans, you know, just studying the show. The Thermians have gone beyond anything that, you know, Long and his buddies could have imagined doing because they had the resources and the technological ability and so on. But fundamentally, they're the same thing. They're just fans of the show that have, you know, used it like a Bible almost to, in one case, construct a fandom. In the other case, construct a whole, you know, society. The thing that we start to have happening as all this plot is being sort of set in motion and we're getting all these elements of the plot coming in and getting established, is we're also getting some of the themes established. So that sort of conflict between, you know, the captain and the others, the way that is sort of plays out in his personal life, where he kind of doesn't have maybe the personal life he pretends to have. You know, he's got this success and this nice house and all this stuff, but he has sort of gotten it at the expense of having a real life. You know, he's just been caught up in the acting. So in a sense, like what has happened in the film, when the story is starting, you've got this scenario where he really has been acting like this character and has effaced his identity. You know, he has no, there's no, you know, him there. He doesn't really have his own identity. His identity in many respects is this show identity, this character that he's created, that he's been playing, and he continues to play even after the show is canceled and over, right? You know, he's continuing to play that role, but it's just a role. And so his whole life is structured by the fact that he has no real life. He only has a simulacrum of a life. You know, he's really an actor in that pure sense. You know, he's acting like he is somebody, but he really, he's nobody. He has no sort of interiority. He has no personal, there's nothing underneath the act in a certain sense. It's just this hollow act. And what has to happen in the course of the movie is he has to fill it. Now, strangely, somewhat ironically, he's not filling the hole, you know, filling this void with something. Instead, he's just effacing the void completely and identifying more fully with this act that he's put on. What he starts to realize, you know, as the film goes on, and what he's called to realize is that he himself has to be the captain. He has to be that character, not just pretend to be that character. He isn't someone else. And this is sort of the strange and kind of brilliant thematic struggle of Galaxy Quest that's sort of being, you know, maybe hidden a little bit. Well, Galaxy Quest sort of begins with the story of these characters who are pretending to be something they're not. And then that keeps ramping up, right? First, they're pretending to be something they're not in the real simple sense that they, you know, they're actors who are continuing to act as these characters. They have fans, they have people who love them, but they only love them for the character. They don't really know who they are. They don't really, and you've got the extreme example of Tim Allen's character where there really is nobody else underneath the act. He's, you know, really sort of taken that role and become, and used it to replace his identity in a certain sense. You know, his whole life is invested in this role and he doesn't really have a life outside the role, but he still is maintaining the illusion that he is a real person outside of this role. So that's a hollow kind of illusion, and he can't really maintain it, but he's trying to maintain it. So weirdly, he's, you know, when I talk about characters being under spell, again, sometimes in stories, what is useful as a writer is to have your characters operate as if they believe the thing, or as if a thing was true, as if they were convinced of something, or as if they didn't realize something that they're going to have to realize or have to learn or have to, you know, do or whatever by the end of the story. What we have progressively, you know, as the story goes on, you know, he's pretending to be something he's not, and it's working out for him in a certain sense. He's receiving the love that he isn't otherwise getting. He's receiving adulation. He's receiving attention. He's receiving money. You know, all these things are coming to him because he's pretending to be something he's not. But because he's getting them as a result of pretending to be something he's not, there's a dissatisfaction at the core of it. He feels like a fraud and an imposter on a certain level. You can see there's this way in which it's caused strife in his personal relationships because, you know, really everybody is relating to the role he plays and not really to himself. He is trying to hide that. He's trying to pretend he doesn't care and he doesn't need, you know, a relation outside of that. It's all business, you know, let's go do this thing together. I'll cut you in next time, all this stuff. But nevertheless, you know, there's a way in which he has, there's just this sort of disconnect between who he seems to be underneath and who he is on the surface. That disconnect is causing all sorts of problems. It progressively causes a problem because he wants the aliens change, move him into their milieu. Now he's pretending to be something he's not on a grander scale, right? You know, it keeps escalating and escalating in that way. He keeps pretending to be something he's not. Eventually he starts to realize the situation. Oh no, these are really aliens. And not just, you know, people that I thought were had, you know, a good effects budget and so on. Eventually he starts to realize, you know, that his actions when he's acting have consequences. So it used to be that he could get away with it and he could, you know, act as if his actions as the act, you know, in the act didn't have consequences, right? But now he's put in the situation where he's pretending to be something he's not, and yet the actions have real consequences. It's not just a TV show anymore, right? Now it's real life, real alien attacks, you know, real division, real conflict, and he's still pretending to be something he's not. That no longer is serving him because even though he's pretending to be something he's not, the things he's doing matter, and they matter on a grand scale. People are living and dying. A whole race is, you know, at war now, or their, you know, war has been exacerbated because of how he, you know, just fired on this guy without, you know, really thinking it through, because he's so used to, like I say, the actions not having consequences. He's so used to living this sort of shell of a life where everything he does is either met with adulation or just has no real significance. But as the story progressively goes on, he's more and more having to take responsibility for his actions and responsibility for the act. So even though it's progressively a problem that he's pretending to be something he's not, to the point where Saris, you know, makes him explain it to the Thermians, and now the Thermians have, you know, equated it for him. You know, he's been trying to see this as acting in an act. You know, it's the thing they do for entertainment, etc. But for the Thermians, he's lying to them. He has lied. That falsity, you know, pretending to be something he's not, has been a lie and a deception. And that's sort of, you know, this line he crossed without realizing it. You know, he kind of has always been doing this, you're living a lie, deceiving himself, deceiving others. it seemed like fun and games, but again, there was that self-deception at the heart of it. The sort of public deception of acting this role gave birth to a self-deception of pretending that he was a real person separate from the role. And now, then it sort of escalated to the point of becoming a real deception because now they're pretending to be these characters in the midst of an alien war, but they're really not. And what's the solution? Well, the solution, interestingly, in Galaxy Quest is to abandon the idea that you're not the role, to fully, completely identify with the role. The solution, strangely, is not to give up the act and, you know, find some authentic self underneath it all. The solution is to realize that you need to abandon the idea that you're acting and completely and fully become those individuals. Drop the act, not, you know, stop trying to be who you aren't, but actually be that thing. So eventually what they do is he becomes the commander. They become the crew. They're now actually piloting the ship for real. The guy's weirdly, you know, studying his own, you know, TV show to learn how to pilot the ship. You know, it's all kind of gone through an interesting, you know, fascinating reversal. So you get this really interesting thematic progression where it's actually a very complicated philosophical concept that's really being progressed and developed, you know, throughout this thing thematically. It's this very interesting, you know, kind of philosophical notion that, you know, somehow they're really like, once your act is producing actions and those actions start to have consequences, it's false to initiate this division between the, and to perceive a division between the act and this real self. You know, the real self is the actor acting, you know? And so we get this sort of weird way where his salvation is to fully embrace, you know, the captain, to actually be that captain for once in his life. And in doing so, not only does he rescue the Thermians, but he actually becomes the leader to this group of people that he's been trying to sort of lead, but who have rejected his leadership because they don't see him as a real and true leader. He's just been pretending to be their leader, but now he's really and truly their leader. So he gets the, you know, the friends that he's had all his life, finally. You know, he gets the sort of, you know, you get a bit of a tacked on romantic relationship thing with Sigourney Weaver. That's a pretty weak aspect of this story in the film, in part because it's very tacked on. You know, you don't get that set up a lot. You know, you get kind of some inklings maybe that they have, you know, she has some interest in him, except for the fact that, you know, he's such a loser. If only he would, you know, really and truly show some leadership, then she might be attracted to him and so on. Again, her character is not particularly well developed, and she even is complaining throughout the film about how her character isn't particularly well developed. But I wouldn't say that the film itself is solving that problem. It kind of continues to keep her thin. Eventually, you know, she just becomes one of the spoils that he gets to enjoy because he finally, you know, manages to break the spell and become the thing that he's been pretending to be. So, you know, there's problems with Galaxy Quest, you know, don't get me wrong. It has, you know, some of the really standard problems that you tend to see in a Hollywood film, particularly insofar as, you know, female characters sort of become token figures and so on. A number of the other characters in the film kind of work in that way. But nevertheless, on a structural level, in terms of how the theme, the plot start to interlink, there's some really, you know, incredible setups and payoffs. There's some really impressive, complicated ways that the theme is building and building and building and escalating and is really developing as a result of these plot moments. And you get some really great situations where they're just sort of doubling it up. You know, I like to call this double tasking, where, you know, ideally in a script, or in any piece of writing, any free sentence you write is going to have two functions. So ideally you have, you know, a line of dialogue that is, you know, telling us how the character feels on a deep level somehow, but is also just getting some information across. You know, you have a situation in Galaxy Quest where they go through the weird, you know, piston area with the pistons and the fire that has no purpose to be on the ship other than like it was in an episode. So they built it in the ship, but there's no function to it. It's just sort of actually an impediment to their progress. Eventually they get to the place, you know, where they see the Omega 13 and all this stuff is happening. And then they hit that button that's going to stop the countdown timer, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of things kind of happening there. Just notice how layered that, you know, scene is. On one hand, we get the fun and games of this, you know, silly, ridiculous, you know, nonsensible, non-sciencey sci-fi element, you know, the kind of thing you'd see in all these, you know, kind of junky old, you know, sci-fi shows. Just to sort of up the tension, you know, for no real reason. At the same time, you get this, again, established really strongly and fully that this thing has been built precisely to the dimensions of this television show. And therefore, again, doing what they would have done on the show, you know, acting like those characters to the point where they really encapsulate and become those characters will work. It's setting up that idea, showing us the Omega 13 also in that sequence. Again, in case we forgot, reminding us a little bit that, like, well, what worked on the show was using the Omega 13. What's going to work here, right, eventually, is using the Omega 13. We get also the information of, like, well, what is Omega 13? And we get, you know, two conflicting ideas. You know, one, well, some people think it's going to, most people think it's going to destroy everything. But I think it could do this other thing. And of course, the other thing is what it does do. But built into that information, built into like the exposition of, well, what it's going to do later, like setting up, you know, that this fail safe, right? Built into that is the reason why they wouldn't just do it anyway. Just press it, you know, and make it work. There's this idea that it's maybe only going to work this one time. They get the one chance, right? You know, and of course, he is going to be the one who has to do it. And so on and so forth. Plus, we get just the simple idea that we get the nice joke of, you know, they press the button and it continues to count down, but of course it's going to stop only at one because that's what normally happens. And we get, you know, a little bit of the sexual tension of those characters starts to come out, which, you know, prefigures the later thing. But again, I think that part of the whole film is a bit tacked on. Nevertheless, you know, Galaxy Quest is a great example of how you can do a really big, bombastic, you know, completely mainstream film with a high concept, with that sort of, you know, broad audience appeal. And yet you can have it really tightly plotted. You can have the themes really kind of work in a complicated way, sort of in the background. And you can kind of also be doing a bit of a subset, you know, kind of subgenre, kind of niche cult fan service, without, you know, sort of losing what maybe makes this broadly appealing to a larger audience.